Сейчас будет перевод. Я сказал вводное слово, в нем ничего не было важного. Итак, спасибо за то, что пришли. Как я говорил ранее, я очень рад быть здесь и рад дать эту лекцию по поводу проекта, над которым я работаю в последнее время. Название проекта будет «Бренды, новое мышление и антимонопольная политика». Это часть работы, которая будет опубликована в июне этого года издательством Cambridge University Press, with two American professors, one an antitrust and competition lawyer, the other one an intellectual property lawyer, Professor Spencer Weber Weiler and Professor Devon Desai. And that forms part of a project that started a few years ago. It was initiated by a very important, I would say, seminal article by Professors Spencer Weber Weiler
Professor Spencer Weiler написал статью on the concept of brands and how actually generally intellectual property lawyers mostly do not engage with that particular concept and they are somehow using the concept of trademark, which is actually quite limited. And then the discussion somehow moved to the area of antitrust law, of competition law, and we organized two conferences, one in London at UCL and another one in Chicago, where actually we had a number of speakers invited, a number of colleagues coming from different, let's say, worlds of academia. So you have antitrust lawyers, competition lawyers, intellectual property lawyers, economists, and business studies people. And we all met two times, and we tried to discuss the way we can conceptualize brands and the way we do it very differently in these different areas of law and social science. I mean, if I can use that term for economics and management studies. And from that, actually, collaborative project, we managed to publish a book, which is forthcoming, as I said, with Cambridge University Press. So the remarks that I will share with you today try a little bit to provide some context on our research question and the discussion we had. Of course, as a competition lawyer, I'm somehow biased in the sense that I will obviously talk more about competition law than about intellectual property law, but I'll make also some remarks with regards to the other three dimensions, as I said before, the intellectual property dimension, the economics dimension, and the business studies dimension, if I can. So brands, I would say, in brand management have become a central feature of the modern economy and a staple of business theory and business practice. I mean, we all kind of live with with the following brands. I mean, we have to cite some of the most prominent ones: Coca-Cola, Nike, Google, Disney, Apple, Microsoft, BMW, IBM, Gucci, Virgin. All are obviously brands and at the same time large companies. Business is fully aware, obviously, of the power and the value of brands. And you can see here, like, I mean, I could not find, I would love to find a world map with not only Western brands, but also a number of Russian and Chinese ones, which are slowly coming as well in context. So it's a little bit a biased map in the sense that this is what I could find on Google. But that actually shows you the quite important amount of brands and the significance of them, in the sense that if we look to them immediately, we have products of these brands that come to our mind and a certain way of thinking, you know, say that these brands try to put forward. So the basic kind of, let's say, the starting point of our discussion is that brands are used to indicate far more than source or quality. Indeed, those functions are far down, I would say, in the list of what most businesses want for their brands. Brands allow businesses to reach consumers directly with messages regarding emotion, identity, and self-worth, such that consumers are no longer buying a product, but they're buying a brand. So businesses pursue this strategy, which actually moves beyond price, product, place, and position, in order to create the idea that a consumer should buy a branded good or service at a higher price than the consumer might otherwise pay. So branding explicitly contemplates reducing or eliminating price competition, as the brand personality cannot be duplicated. You might duplicate probably the design, and you can see that in many of the studies that have been done on fashion. You'll see that many, there's a kind of an inverse kind of a pyramid, basically, where you have very kind of upscale brands that are setting the tone for fashion products, so let's say clothes, and then you have a knockoff type of lower or intermediate brands, which are copying basically the features of the high-scale brand. Of course, you know, people that buy the intermediate or low-scale brands, they know very well that they may be buying a product that looks like the product of the upscale brand, but definitely they're not buying the experience and the status that is provided by the high-scale brand. So branding basically, as I said, it tries somehow to promote product differentiation. So it's a product differentiation tactic that allows a branded good to turn a commodity into a special category that sees higher margins compared to the others in the marketplace. So if we try to think a little bit about the concept of brand, I would say that from a business point of view, brands can be defined as levers that permit companies to differentiate their products and services, price discriminate, and increase customer loyalty. Now, from an economic point of view, economists, I will say, and I will talk a little bit more about this later, have thought about at least two roles that brands can play. One, which I will say is probably largely positive, the other one might probably be considered as slightly negative. So the positive role is informing and signaling. So brands may convey information about the product's price or quality to consumers. So as such, branding may involve choice of names, terms, symbols, and designs, which signal the quality of the goods of a particular seller, and therefore attempt to differentiate from that of its competitors. The other role is, persuading. Persuading is basically we try to persuade consumers to buy a product which they will not have otherwise purchased. So somehow brands are somehow used to create a new demand that did not exist before. So in terms of the first aspect, informing and signaling, I mean, we can take in mind, we can actually take the example of an experience good, such as the new shampoo, where the quality of the product can only be observed after you use it. For such products, the brand may indicate to consumers that a new product is of high quality. Another example of the informing and signaling view is what's going on with regards to franchising and franchising literature, which basically tries to understand why, you know, an entrepreneur decides to pay to open a Subway or McDonald's store rather than an open and independent restaurant. One reason for probably might be that the brand signals the product will satisfy some form of minimum quality, and in a way, this particular and in a sense, you know, if you have a franchise contract,
есть
you have a
contract франшизы, который предприниматель реализует, соблюдая определенные стандарты минимального качества.
And that
компания-владелица нас следит, чтобы эти стандарты минимальные соблюдались в различных местах мира.
Whenever they go and
гарантируется определенное качество, если человек в любой точке мира пойдет в Макдональдс, в любой стране, в США, в Греции, есть ожидание, что это качество будет соблюдаться.
And I would say in this particular case, we might obviously have a philosophical challenge in the sense that, well, should we actually rely on the individual, the autonomy of the individual in making choices, or actually should we somehow think that the persuading effect of advertising violate somehow this particular autonomy of the individual making choices, in particular if branding leads to some choice architecture. And I will actually discuss about the concept of choice architecture a little bit later. Now, from the point of view of competition law now, the term of art brands is often used in different areas of competition law, and in European competition law is an example. But the way it's used is very particular because it used with the aim of providing factual information on the competitive or not relation between products or services provided by different economic actors. So the Commission, European Commission often refers to brands in its mergers on antitrust decisions, for example, saying that the products or services of brand X enter competition on the relevant market with products or services of brand Y. So the term brand is used in this context with the aim to provide some factual, let's say, observation on the operation of the specific relevant market. But it does not lead to further inferences. I mean, there's no theory, actually, of brand that will enable us to take these observations and put them in a different context. So from that perspective, I would say that if one thinks of the concept of brands as an operational concept, and what I mean by operational concept is a concept that links theoretical concepts, so based on theory, to simple factual observations, well, this is not provided by the concept of brand in EU competition law. So it's a factual concept, but it's not basically considered as an operational concept. And I would say there may be different reasons for that. One of the possible reasons is the fact that, you know, classical price theory that has been the foundation, intellectual foundation of competition law, the development of competition law, has been quite ambiguous with regards to the concept of brands. Basically, when you talk to economists about brands, they think with the concepts of product differentiation, imperfect competition, or monopolistic competition, which basically are concepts that in the welfare economics tradition would discuss the role of brands in the competitive process. So product differentiation, which is somehow the focus of economic study, became the focus of economic inquiry only, let's say, starting in the 1930s. Of course, you know, Marshall referred in his famous Principle of Economics, referred to the concept of brands in his book in 1890, but the real, somehow, research on the product differentiation came in the 1930s. And in a way, we have two traditions at the time that emerge. One, which I would say is a more critical tradition to product differentiation, that of John Robinson, you know, took the view that, well, product differentiation is a departure from that ideal of perfect competition, and therefore she used the term imperfect competition to quantify the situation of product heterogeneity. Basically, that you know, would be a divergence from the direction to go, that of perfect competition. And from the other side, we have Chamberlain, who in his theory of monopolistic competition took a different perspective, focusing rather on the concept of the firm rather than that of industry, as basically John Robinson did. and viewed product differentiation as a normal fact of economic life, the concept of monopolistic competition, describing the process of many sellers who produce heterogeneous products in response to a divergent demand and preferences of consumers. So I would say these contrasting views of a product differentiation reflect the difficulties of the concept of brands and brand theory to gain acceptance as a useful operational concept in competition law. So what actually this presentation, which is going to be short, is going to try to examine is first the semantics of brands. Let's say what exactly, how the concept of brands has evolved through time and is actually presenting quite interesting challenges right now to business scholars, economists, and lawyers. And secondly, the difficult normative choices that will entail the integration of brands in the toolbox of competition authorities and courts, in particular in view of the goals pursued by competition law. The evolving semantics of brands. Now, noted by my co-editors, Devin Desai and Spencer Weber-Waller in their seminal contribution on brands and IP law, although there is a voluminous literature that explores brand theories, brand strategies, brand meaning, and brand functions, it is difficult to find a succinct definition of what a brand is. Some authors characterize brands as a complex symbol that incorporates consumers' motives, feelings, logics, and attitudes. For our purposes, I will refer to the brands as manufacturer or service providers coordinated use of design, packaging, graphics, logos, advertising, promotion, public relations, marketing, distribution, pricing, communications, and other strategies in order to create a durable identity and loyalty with the consumers. So the part of the problem, let's say, of the difficulty of defining brands comes from the historical accounts of the development of trademarks, which often look to early uses of markings on goods as examples, if not the seeds, of modern trademark uses and law. Although many different ancient and medieval civilizations, from the Indus River Valley to China, to several Mediterranean cultures to Nigeria, to the Arab Empire and to medieval England, used brands and a variety of other commercial symbols to indicate ownership and facilitate commerce, none of those uses corresponds to modern brands. As economies grew and centralized under the auspices of a royal, religious, or a guild authority, marks were actually used to regulate industry. Unlike the modern trademark systems that we have, where the company decides whether and what trademark to use, ancient and medieval industries did not choose to use marks. Instead, the government required these industries to use marks in order to allow the government to trace a good to a specific manufacturer so it could be held accountable for products that did not meet government-established standards. So it was basically a mechanism in order to build liability, to enable actually the liability of manufacturers. So even in such limited market systems, as trade expanded beyond the local environs and reached far-flung areas, marks came to indicate source and quality. In some specific industry sectors leading up to the 19th century, the British law system began to recognize the goodwill value and the property-like interest that grew with the use of liability marks. So we have, let's say, a movement from marks as an instrument of liability to marks as a property right, which comes out of the fact that we have expanded trade, and obviously the idea of using these marks in order to implement the standards that have been defined by the governments of a specific region are not basically anymore the major reason for the major rationale for the development of brands. So once this step has been accomplished, once the step from a liability, let's say, device to a property right has been accomplished, and the market economy moved to a pure, more pure, I would say, private market system, and basically away from face-to-face transactions. In a way, you know, we are, all economy is based on the concept of trust. I mean, we We trust, actually, others in exchanging with them. And obviously, the more, and this trust might be personal, in the sense that you know the other person is part of your family, it's part of your tribe. It's, so in this particular case, you don't really have institutional trust. It's personal trust.
I use a little bit of distinction between institutional and institutionalized
trust. But the more actually you come to, you know, not face-to-face transaction, but somehow transactions done in the market, which is actually broader, and which you don't really engage with people that know, in this case, you know, you need to have institutionalized trust. And in a way, the trademark system was used to, in a way, to generate this particular trust because of the fact that they provide basically symbols of origin and quality. So somehow we move from a system of liability rights instead to property rights, and these property rights actually enable the creation of markets where actually exchanges between strangers can happen. Nonetheless, actually using marks for the utilitarian provision of information regarding origin and quality is only, I think, and not only me, but a number of scholars right now, of what brands really mean. Brands have more complex characteristics which are related to image building and include status, power, inherent value, and finally the development of brand personality. So they have a transformational role. Marks do not only convey information and offer, you know, this is, let's say, conveyance of information is only part of the image building, but I would say they do much more. So unlike trademark law, which somehow is still stuck to a certain degree to this picture of brands as property rights, which enable, let's say, quality and promote trust on quality and the provenance of goods and the origin of goods, the business literature has moved quickly to keep pace with the realities of modern branding. Writers in the early 1980s, remarked my colleagues Spencer Weber-Waller and Devon Desai, defined the brand in terms roughly coextensive with the legal definition of a trademark. So basically, brands and trademarks were considered the same thing. But by the end of the 1990s, brand theories have moved well beyond considering brands as only indicating source and or guaranteeing quality, but instead explicitly saw them as encompassing a broader array of functions. Some authors actually documented the growth of the brand, which entails a company creating a personality for a brand that a consumer then incorporates into how he or she expresses he or her own self, an ideal self, or specific dimensions of the self. I mean, many of you probably are using Apple, you know, computers. And if you go, let's say, to a UCL library, you will see 95% of the students using basically Apple computers, and I'm not making the advertising for Apple. But it indicates, say, a certain way of being. See, those who are buying Apple have a certain image about, you know, what exactly they are and what this particular brand represents. And that differentiates them from people that actually are buying PCs. And I say PCs, and I'm not saying Hewlett Packard, Dell, etc., because basically Apple has managed very successfully to create a particular personality, an image for their brand, which differentiates it from any other product that basically fulfills the same functions. I mean, a computer is a computer, but Apple is more than just a computer. So, in a way, a brand becomes a mental shortcut that discourages rational thought and infusing with the spirit of the maker, a gathering, an inspiration. A brand is a semiotic enterprise of the firm, the companion spirit of the firm, an hologram of the firm, as actually indicates Sherry. And you think about Apple, you think immediately of, obviously, the founder of Apple and his personality. So it's very much linked, actually, to a personality rather than to the quality, let's say, of the product. Of course, you know, quality is a message that is provided, but it's definitely not the main one with regards to the use of this particular brand. So let's say that this is, I think, a quite important insight So this idea that the brands are allowing companies to move beyond the so-called, in the business literature, 4 P's, product, price, place, and promotion, which the competitor can duplicate at the end of the story, to include the 5th P, personality, the personality of a company, which competitors could not copy. So even if Samsung, Fujitsu are copying the design of Apple computers, I'm using Apple and
Apple.
White one looks a little bit like, you know, an Apple computer, so it's definitely,
you can copy that. Apple, можно это все
скопировать. Copy the colors, but you cannot copy, obviously, the status of the personality of the Apple computer.
Okay?
So I'm using a PC, I'm not a cool person. If we, you know, think about the way actually Apple wants to provide this message of differentiation, product differentiation.
All right, so
I would say from a public policy perspective, I mean, that obviously raises a number of questions in the way actually how the legal system, and in particular here competition law, should deal with this type of understandings of the concept of brand. I mean, moving away from this concept of trademarks, which are there to ensure quality and origin of the good. And I would say one of the most difficult issues to resolve when discussing about the added value offered by the concept of brand in competition law has to do with the role of consumers in the process of product differentiation, which is, as I said, inherent in the existence of brand. In competition law, the aim of protecting consumers implies that the outcome consequences of a specific practice on consumers matter before any decision on the lawfulness or unlawfulness of the practice. So I'm taking that perspective of consumer welfare. I accept that you might take a very different perspective in competition law. I'm for value pluralism in competition law, but I will definitely speak here on the majoritarian perspective, which is that competition law is there in order to promote consumer welfare
and interests of consumers.
Now, if we take that perspective, I would say there are various possible normative assumptions as to the relation between brands and consumer interests in this context. So if one takes the perspective of price theory, the protection of consumer surplus, the consumer part of the deadweight loss suffered as a result of the restriction of competition, should form the main focus of the analysis. As the development of the brand involves fixed costs that need to be recuperated over time, firms will not invest on it unless they're able to charge higher than competitive prices. So a price increase will obviously lead to a volume effect, basically less products available in the market because the price is higher, so less people can buy them. And obviously, a category of consumers will suffer from this price increase. So these consumers will not be able to buy products that they were able to buy before because of the price increase. And we can rely on revealed preferences, on past consumption patterns of consumers to somehow infer this particular effect. So under this narrow definition of consumer surplus, the overcharge, the extra price that is paid by the consumers, should not be of concern for competition law enforcement, as it constitutes a wealth transfer from the buyers to the sellers. So the suppliers may be in a position to compensate, hypothetically always, because we are in a Caldor-Hicks efficiency criterion, the loss that consumers have suffered while still being able to compensate this welfare transfer with their own losses following the volume effect. So basically the idea is that consumers are paying a higher price, but that obviously affects some consumers, but in general, the consumers that still buy the product, they benefit from higher quality. So from that perspective, there is a compensation, at least potential compensation, of the sociological group of consumers in general from the fact that there is higher quality provided. And I would say that could be a possible way of understanding the issue and quite positive from that perspective to brands. If you take a very narrow efficiency-driven perspective on we're just interested in consumer surplus, and we're not interested, let's say, in the wealth transfer from consumers to suppliers. Now, the matrix changes if we move beyond consumer surplus and include the analysis the wealth transfer that consumers may have incurred because of the overcharges that resulted from the development of brands and increased product differentiation. This may not only relate to higher prices, but could also cover many other parameters of competition, quality, variety, innovation. In this case, both the loss of consumer surplus and wealth transfers will be compared to the total efficiency gains pertaining to the supplier, thus enabling a cost-benefit analysis of the effect of the conduct on the welfare of a specific group of market actors, direct or indirect consumers. So in a certain way, here, the assumption would be that brands and product differentiation will lead to an increased ability and incentive for brand owners to increase prices for consumers that do not switch to other brands or competing products, basically exploiting these consumers. Now, that could be from that perspective, you know, if you take that perspective, then obviously brands might be an instrument of exploitation of consumers, and therefore you need to develop some kind of more negative, say, competition policy towards brands. And final perspective, it could be that of some authors claiming that the objective of competition law is to promote consumer choice. And in this particular case, you will say that, well, by offering brands, you have actually, theoretically, more choice. But of course, this obviously doesn't take into account the fact that choice might be illusionary, might be an illusion. I mean, you look at this particular image, you see a variety of brands which are basically controlled by few market players, global market players. So we might have the illusion of choice in the sense of, you know, having a number of brands which we can choose, but we know that the actors actually, these brands belong to a specific and quite limited amount of economic actors. Now, that's not a problem, of course, because you might have a lot of competition between these different companies developing different brands in order, let's say, to win particular segments of the market. I would say the question we might have in this case, and if consumers, let's say, are choosing their free will that this particular brand presents me better than this one, you know, there's absolutely no problem in having, let's say, this amount of brands, even controlled, let's say, by a few players. However, the idea, however, one might have is that the firms with their marketing activities may shape endogenously consumer preferences by establishing an artificial selection process. So the idea would be that preferences here will be constructed rather than revealed. And in that particular sense, it's very crucial to understand what is actually how consumer preferences are formed and what is the role of branding in the formation of these consumer preferences. Because if you think that basically the firms are creating a choice architecture that will somehow lead us to make particular choices, then obviously this will be antithetical to the idea that, well, consumers are free to, you know, autonomously they decide to choose a specific brand. And there's absolutely no problem in that regard, because, you know, as long as there is competition, let's say, between different groups of brands. Now, so from my perspective, so in this particular paper, what I did, because there hasn't been any particular study, at least to my knowledge, with regards to the formation of preferences as to brands, I looked to another technique of product differentiation, which is very much linked to brands advertising. And I will say advertising, I was very surprised to find out, is an almost entirely 20th century project in view of the focus of the economic theory in the 19th century on the development of the perfect competition paradigm, which suggests no role for product differentiation. And I would say there are different periods in the way economists conceive the concept of brands. I would say three periods. The concept of advertising. During the first period, economists perceive advertising as a tool to alter consumer preferences and to create product differentiation and brand loyalty. So the dominant perception of the time was that advertising leads to a waste of resources and has an entry deterrence effect, in the sense that if you know you have a brand or a good that is heavily advertised, and in a way you have manipulated the preferences of consumers in favor of that particular product of this firm, then it's very difficult for other firms to enter this market. It's kind of an entry barrier to that market. And I will say that particular view was represented by a number of authors like John Robinson, which also referred to a number of empirical studies in order to show that advertising actually was aiming to persuade consumers to be loyal. So it was actually considered as a barrier to entry. So I would call it the persuasive view of advertising. A different approach was advanced by the proponents of the informative view, which is actually coming from Chicago, so it's a very different perspective, which considers that the principal function of advertising is to convey information to consumers, and from that perspective, to help them choose a product and services that correspond to their preferences. And one of the main proponents, of the early proponents of that school is Telser, who has done also a lot of work for competition economists I'm familiar with in the area of resale price maintenance. And Telser basically argued that advertising is frequently a means of entry and a sign of competition. It's an important source of information for consumers. And in a way, advertising, according to this point of view, constitutes a way for the firms to signal to consumers that they are the most efficient, low-cost firms since they seek demand expansion through advertising. So in a way, advertising stimulates price comparisons and therefore price competition. So this particular view took a very positive perspective on advertising and actually considered that advertising cannot be an entry barrier, but actually can generate entry because it will enable low-cost firms and more efficient firms that provide quality at a lower cost to make their product more known to consumers and to show that they are better than incumbents. And finally, the third view that emerged, tradition, let's say, that emerged in the economics of advertising is a complementary view. Under this view, consumers possess stable preferences, and advertising directly enters these preferences in a manner that is complementary to the consumption of the advertised product. What I mean by that is that consumers value social prestige, and advertising by a firm is an input that contributes towards that prestige which is enjoyed when the firm's products are consumed. So basically, the consumers are not only trying to buy a product, they're also trying to buy the associated social prestige, which could be also considered as an input in that particular product, a valued input to that particular product. So it is possible, if you take that view, that firms may compete in the same prestige market even if they produce different market goods. So, for example, you would say that firms that produce jewelry and firms that produce fashion clothes might be in competition with each other in that particular aspect of prestige, and the prestige market perceived as a commodity. So that is somehow this particular perspective of a complementary view. So the decision from a competition authority to intervene in this context depends on the view one takes of product differentiation and its relation with regards to the real preferences of consumers. So those adept of the informative or complementary view will emphasize the value of product differentiation as an instrument to promote consumer welfare and consumer choice. And those adepts of the persuasive view will be more reticent to intervene in order to ensure that consumer welfare is preserved and that consumers offer a choice. It's also to refer to the neuroeconomics research, which has also highlighted how the effective hot mode decision making and compassionate emotions in the drive consumer stays and create brand loyalty. So a regulator, which could be inspired by paternalistic objectives, would strive in this case to ensure that brand differentiation corresponds to the cold state preferences of the consumer rather than the instigated hot mode decision making. So I actually make the distinction between hot mode and cold state preference, in the sense that, as you probably are familiar with the literature, behavioral economics literature, we are actually having operating under two modes, mode one and mode two. Mode one is a very much kind of intuitive way of thinking, a gut feeling type of decisions. Mode two is requiring a sophisticated cost-benefit analysis, so kind of more cold state type of decision making. And here one could say that, well, if we look to real preferences and we think that it's better to define these real preferences as basically those that are formed when we are in a cold state mode of decision making, then a decision maker that is inspired by, let's say, paternalistic or soft paternalistic, let's say, perspectives will, in this case, be biased in the sense that you'll prefer to intervene in order to ensure that we make decisions under a cold state. Now, the final thing I wanted to discuss is private labels and how actually I think this new, somehow commercial reality is providing a new rhetoric, a new narrative on brands. Now, I guess you all know private labels. I mean, in certain areas, in the food, for example, retail sector in the UK, I mean, these are pretty much used. For example, you have big retailers like Tesco, who actually provide their own Tesco brand for different types of food. And these private labels, they compete with a number of national brands, such as Procter & Gamble and different types of national brands, not necessarily, you know, only sold in this particular retailer. And we have this, but it's a very important development. And if you don't want to define private labels, the term refers to all products sold under a retailer's brand, which could be the retailer's own name, store brand, or a brand created by a manufacturer exclusively for the retailer who defines the characteristics of the product. So we call this the generic brand. So private label products are generally exclusively distributed by the retailer along the national brand products, which are marketed by manufacturers throughout the national market and not only the specific retailer's outlet. So private labels usually appeal to consumers because of their lower price. Hence, product differentiation by private labels may counteract the effect of differentiation strategies employed by national brand suppliers who aim to increase their prices and improve their profitability. So this brings some form of a horizontal dimension in the relationship between suppliers and retailers. Because basically, if you think about the way we structure the competition analysis, we make a distinction between horizontal and vertical restraints. And vertical restraints are restrictions of competition that emanate from relations between suppliers and retailers, which actually are different stages of the commercialization and production process. While here, actually, you have a retailer that competes with the supplier horizontally because his products, private labels, compete with the products of the supplier, who they're also distributing. I mean, Tesco, you don't find only Tesco products. Products as well. And the private labels market share has been constantly growing, in particular, as I said, in the food sector, and represents a significant volume of retail sales in Europe. And I will say that even the quality of private labels has changed, and you have now different types of private labels, and just quality private labels. So you might have, let's say, Tesco that has, you know, certain brands that are basically, let's say, generics, very cheap, but then they also have a Tesco high-quality brand, which can offer another. So that, you know, the quality, let's say, improved considerably
качество значительно улучшилось в 90-е и 2000-е годы.
So you have obviously low prices, and in a way that is the main argument for consumers to buy this particular product, but because of the increase of the quality of the private labels, you might finish by having a number of national brands being excluded from the market if their quality seems to be close enough to the quality of the private labels. So the exclusion of second-tier national brands from the market has been one of the consequences of the introduction of private labels. Now, what are the consequences for the consumers? Some brands have been excluded from the market. Should that be of concern to us? Well, the commercialization of private labels obviously increases consumer choice because it offers a lower price substitute to the consumer. So the system also introduces a countervailing buying power for retailers against the market power of national brand owners. So in case you have markets where the national brand owners have actually important market power. So let's say you have the market power of the supplier, of the national brand supplier, from one side, and then you have the bargaining buying power of the retailer on the buying side, and that somehow counteracts the possible effects of market power from the seller side. But empirical studies have also showed that competition from private labels might not lead to lower prices for national brand products. So it might not necessarily lead to this effect of creating a constraint, a price constraint to national brand owners. Consumers with a high degree of loyalty to the manufacturer's brand will not benefit from the introduction of private label products. Steiner in particular has done quite a lot of work on the competition between national brands and private label competition. And basically, you know, as he says in this paper, the trade-off for the national brand producer facing a private label is between exploiting the loyal consumers with a high price and competing for the switching consumer with a lower price, competing with a private label. When the fraction of the loyals is high, the national brand will concentrate on the loyal segment and a private label will be introduced at the lower price. On the other hand, when the fraction of loyals is low, the national brand finds it optimal to offer an exclusivity contract to the retailer at a lower price and no private label will be introduced. So basically, the retailer here is going to use a possibility, has to develop a private label to get basically an exclusivity agreement from the supplier, or some payments, slotting allowances might be one, which will have somehow will incentivize him not to, you know, create this particular private label. So if the national brand producer serves both loyal and switching consumers initially, the price of the national brand will be relatively low. In such a situation, the private label competition will lead to an increase in the price of the national brand. The reason is that the national brand producer decides not to serve the switching consumers to which a private label is offered, and instead sets a high price to serve only loyal consumers. Loyal consumers are worse off due to a higher price on the national brand, while switching consumers are better off when offered a low price private label. It turns out that in some cases, consumers on aggregate benefit from private label introduction, in other cases, they are worse off. So it's a kind of case-by-case analysis, which depends on the percentage of loyal consumers to basically switching consumers, to what could be a contestable part of the market. And of course, it doesn't really provide a very clear picture of what to do, other than to have to apply a sort of case-by-case analysis, rule of reason analysis in this context. So it follows that the effects of private labels on consumers is ambiguous and largely depends on the characteristics of consumer demand for the specific product. Now, second aspect which one might also raise with regards to private labels is the gatekeeper role of the retailer, which in some cases might limit consumer choice and variety. Now, this will not happen if you know, you have leading national brands, mass stock brands. I mean, if you are a retailer, you need to stock Coca-Cola
in terms of soft drinks.
I mean, this is a kind of a mass stock brand, which in any way plays a role of quality certification for the retailer in interstore competition. So retailers competing with other retailers, and therefore these mass stock products must be somehow included in his sales. However, private labels may change the power relation between suppliers and retailers to the benefit of retailers in contexts where you don't have mass stock brands. So for, let's say, second tier type of brands. And in a way, we can see that this effect somehow emerging in the sense that in markets where you have private labels, basically you have a mass stock kind of national brands that's still there and the private labels, but then all the other brands have gone out of the market. Or actually what happens is that the manufacturers are now producing for the private label. So from that perspective, you might probably have effects on innovation because you have less players active in the market and probably less R&D and innovation going on for the development of the product. Now, this is an open question because, of course, we don't really have data about the amount of innovation that is actually happening following the introduction of private labels and the exclusion of second-tier type of national brands. The European Commission has been doing quite a lot of work in this area. Actually, there is a recent report that was published in October 2014 by an economic consultancy looking specifically to the effects of private labels in the food sector on innovation and consumer choice. And I would say it's a very interesting read, looking also to different member states' data. So from that perspective, I mean, we are building slowly some knowledge base on which to base our decisions as competition authorities generally do. So as you see, the concept of brands and generally branding creates quite important challenges to competition law thinking, and that comes out of the fact that economists and side business studies people have been thinking in different ways about the concept of brand, and somehow there's a need to develop more dialogue between these two disciplines in order to emerge a theory, let's say, of brand and how actually these work in the economic context. And also from a legal perspective, I would say this, we need to move away from this old style definition of brands as basically being a trademark, which guarantees the origins and the quality of the good, to something which takes into account the broader perspective on brands that has been somehow the reality of modern business, this idea of personality brands as holograms of firms, in which case I would say intellectual property law might you know, learn quite a lot and might probably need to somehow to think about the way it introduces the social branding idea in the way actually they perceive the role of brands. But competition law, I would say, even more because of the quite difficult normative choices and assumptions that we need to make in order to base our decisions on solid grounds, theoretical grounds. And I would say, as I said before, you have very different perspectives on things. And for the time being, I do not see really a consensus emerging, consensus view emerging. So it's a matter to keep an eye on and to reflect more generally. Thank you for your attention.
Есть ли какие-то мысли по поводу того, как российское антимонопольное законодательство в этой сфере, какие-то есть мнения? Есть много брендовых продуктов, возникающих у вас. Это связано с каким образом с антимонопольным законодательством.
I'll repeat in Russian. Okay. For the non-speaking audience, I asked Dr. Yanis about Russian. Yes.
Yeah, as I said before, I mean, there are different ways of thinking in economics,
lawyers,
I would say, have not really thought about that problem. And I would say one of the benefits kind of originality of our project was that it was the first time that we're actually thinking about the concept of brands. Until now, the only lawyers that thought about brands were the intellectual property lawyers, but they didn't really think about brands. They actually thought about trademarks. So from my perspective, you know, that's not enough. Because obviously, there is a broader reality than just the trademark. I mean, in the sense that you have this idea of personality, but also you have this idea of social branding. What I mean by social branding, I mean that there is an interaction.
I mean,
usually brands are conceived as a one-way communication game. So the firm is defined the brand, and this is communicated to the consumers. But as we see now is a development of social branding, of brands that are an interaction between consumers and suppliers. Preferences, I mean, and design. So, for example, if Apple tomorrow decides to turn to a different way of designing the products, the community that they have created of Apple users will somehow react and will say, well, wait a moment, we are also part of the brand. We define that brand as well. So you cannot do that. So in a way, brand is not anymore defined only by the supplier, but is defined in dialogue, basically, with the consumers of that particular brand. So the group, the community that they have created. So in this, I would say, creates even more challenges for competition law, which is the fact that sometimes, you know, the preferences of the competition law is interested in the preferences of the consumers, I mean, in a certain degree. And the assumption is that, well, you know, brands are providing either messages to consumers' information and consumers are making their choice, or brands are basically exploiting consumers and creating a choice architecture, and it's basically the choice of the supplier. But they don't really see the point of view that, you know, it might be a dialogic process. I mean, both actually are interacting with each other. And now this is a dimension that hasn't been really thought through in the legal system at all. So from my perspective, I'll make my answer shorter, is that intellectual property lawyers, they think about trademarks, they haven't thought about brands. Competition lawyers, actually, they now start thinking about brands, and our work is the first one on this particular area. But as I said before, it's a very complex reality, and for the time being, we don't have a clear picture about the way, actually, this the legal system actually will evolve and where they will engage with the concept of brand. Because it depends on the normative choices and assumptions that the decision maker will make.
Бренда,
that's a policy decision. That's not just legal issue. Policy
принятия решения. Это связано с политическими вопросами, не юридическими вопросами.
Clear.
какой сфере антимонопольного законодательства?
Competition. I mean, the different parts of competition might be interested. I mean, in the sense, I mean, and in the paper that I actually, by the way, you can find a paper
вот
on SSRN,
which
deals with a number of issues. I mean, it's
здесь
much more, many more issues than the ones that I raise here. Is looking precisely to the way EU competition law has engaged with the concept of brands, either in antitrust or in merger control cases. And tries to assess basically if there is any coherent legal response to the challenges that are that the concept of brand sets to competition in the
sphere of concurrency. A question for you.
My name is Anatoly. I'm Anatoly Semyonov. I'm ombudsman in intellectual property in Russia. This is some kind of social obligation protecting the entrepreneurs.
Я занимаюсь защитой предпринимателей в сфере собственности, интеллектуальной собственности. Когда меня пригласили на вашу лекцию, я был очень заинтересован в тех проблемах, которые вы подняли. Я ознакомился с вашей статьей. Это связано с проблемой сейчас в российском законодательстве рассматриваемой и в судебной практике. Определенные судебные случаи. В России такая проблема.
First of all, nobody understands what is the trademark.
Никто не понимает, что такое торговая марка. Это естественное право или это монопольная привилегия?
Pretty many people understand that
trademark. Многие люди понимают. Торговая марка, как другие права интеллектуальной собственности. Это как и другое конституционное право, право импортировать, торговать. Но есть определенные ограничения прав интеллектуальной собственности, так как в Конституции нашей страны говорится, что нельзя осуществлять право, если вы нарушаете права других тем самым. Касаясь осуществления прав интеллектуальной собственности, здесь размытая граница, где ваше право уже перестает существовать, где вы можете реализовать свое право, где нет. Когда вы говорите о психологических и других аспектах торговой марки, это также связано с осуществлением прав. Важно помнить, что некоторые бренды, социальные бренды, создаются совместно не только владельцем бренда, но и обществом. Это уже отражено в законодательстве. Например, в России нельзя продать торговую марку, если это приведет к замешательству пользователей. Например, все помнят, этот продукт производится этим, этой компанией, этим человеком. И вы, передав этот продукт другому, создается замешательство пользователей. То есть вот эту сделку нельзя будет осуществить. Согласно законодательству, есть такая статья. Нельзя продавать торговую марку, если это приведет к замешательству потребителей. То есть определенные привычки республики также важны. Но также, что мне интересно, когда права перестают существовать. Возможно, вы этот вопрос не осветили. Если говорить об истечении прав, если вы что-то покупаете с определенной торговой маркой, это собственность бренда, и если есть какой-то знак, есть другая проблема. Обычная собственность защищается без исключительных прав, но интеллектуальная собственность защищается на основе национального законодательства. Не во всех странах равным образом происходит защита интеллектуальной собственности. Таким образом, есть проблема, когда продукт в другие страны поступает. Может быть, прекращение прав, связанное с национальными особенностями закона, связанные с ожиданиями потребителями в той или иной стране. Есть определенные, может, национальные принципы истечения прав. И у владельца бренда могут быть претензии, связанные с его брендом. И это может входить в противоречие с национальным законодательством. Есть три причины истечения прав на национальном уровне. Это ценовая дискриминация. В России, к сожалению, есть две другие плохие причины. Дискриминация по качеству и дискриминация по типу товара. Например, этот вид товара на рынке России, а его нет на рынке США. Может быть, так называемый бренд юридической фальсификации в России. Например, продукт может быть низкого качества, хотя такие бренды есть в США, но там качество намного выше. То есть здесь это вопрос защиты торговой марки. Заслуживает ли торговая марка защиты в таких случаях, когда марка связана с продуктом, который юридически фальсифицированный продукт? Вот вопросы, которые возникают в моей практике работы. Не думаю, что можете сказать много по этому вопросу, но что-нибудь по защите интересов использователя.
What is that social welfare contribution? It's a fact that it ensures, as I said before,
как я ранее говорил, чтобы обеспечить минимальное качество различных продуктов для владельца бренда,
I'm against this idea of the natural right, but I'm also against this idea that this is a privilege or a right, and as I said, I wrote an article in 2006 on the interaction between competition and intellectual property, and I was advancing a different view of intellectual property, but at the same time I was also criticizing those that were saying that intellectual property rights are basically monopolistic rights. First, because you have a trademark, it doesn't mean that you have a market power in particular relevant market. I mean, Apple is competing with a number of other brands. The fact you have a trademark doesn't mean that you actually have the possibility to raise the price profitably and decrease output and somehow exploit consumers. I mean, it doesn't really mean that. So from that perspective, you cannot say that you have a monopoly. You don't have.
Не обязательно, что у вас есть определенная монополия.
Well, the aftermarket is a different issue, and there is not actually is a different issue from the fact that you might, in some cases, you might say that a particular firm having a brand might finish by having market power in the aftermarket, but on the condition, very strict condition, that the consumers are not taking into account this aftermarket where they are making a decision on the primary market. And so EU competition law is very clear about that particular research, basically following the US case law, the Kodak case, in that, and be extremely careful not to define markets as being the relevant market of the brand. So it has been done in very specific, very few cases, and based on very different elements, like the fact that it was too difficult for the consumer to make these decisions at the time of the primary, when they were buying the primary product, or there was not enough competition at the primary product market. So you have very important conditions, restrictive conditions for that to happen. So I'm against this idea as well, because, I mean, obviously you need to have an analysis of what could be the effects on the market. You cannot just see, oh, I see a trademark, therefore I see a privilege or a monopoly. I mean, there should be the step of defining that market and making an assessment. Now, with regards to the distinction between existence and exercise, and that is something that obviously has been at the DNA of European law, and this is a way actually European court tried to deal with the constitutional aspect of having a federal EU competition law, but not having an EU intellectual property law, the intellectual property law being that of the member states. And so they said, well, what concerns the exercise of that intellectual property right is basically EU competition law might interfere there. But what with regards to the existence of the intellectual property right, it's basically a matter of national law. However, this distinction, and they tried to develop a criterion for defining the distinction between existence and exercise, and basically they define a specific function of an intellectual property right in question as framing the boundaries of the existence. Okay? So for trademarks, you have cases we basically define what is a function of the trademark, and you know, the member states are free to develop intellectual property law and trademarks within this particular framework and this limit. Now, the thing is, however, that this distinction, I think, has, although it's still good law, has in practice collapsed, because basically it's very difficult to distinguish existence and exercise. And in some cases, the European competition law has gone as far as saying, well, the type of intellectual property right that this member state has chosen is not a really valuable intellectual property right. So it basically interferes with the possibility of the member state to define intellectual property. I'm thinking about the Magill case, which is a case concerning refusal to license, in which case the court basically said that, well, I mean, did not say it explicitly, but many interpreted the court's position as being that the court somehow interfered with the fact that the Irish
intellectual property law was providing, let's say, intellectual property right to basically simple data, to a database is basically providing nothing, than just a collection of data. So from that perspective, I would say that there is a tension there with regards to what is defined by the distinction between existence and exercise. And as you said, of course, there is also a lot of literature, and in the book that we published, there's an article by one of my colleagues at UCL, Ilana Pima, on dilution. And actually, I would say in the way the court is integrating also this idea of value of the trademark and the fact that this kind of psychological element in a way of image or personality, in a way actually they define the specific functions of intellectual, of the trademark. So somehow you see there some evolution going on at the court jurisprudence level with regards to broadening up the concept of specific function of a trademark. And therefore, what can be protected, providing the intellectual property holder with extra rights. Now, you mentioned exhaustion. Of course, this is a very interesting issue. It doesn't relate to competition law as such directly. I mean, it's more trade law kind of base. Of course, competition policy, why it's obviously very important. And I know the current debates here as well to move from a national exhaustion to a regional exhaustion system or even international exhaustion. I just finished a report for the Eurasian Economic Commission with a number of colleagues, intellectual property lawyers from the US and the UK, where basically we are examining the legal, let's say, framework of moving from a national exhaustion regime to an international exhaustion regime or a differentiated international exhaustion regime. Now, and this report will be available soon, so you'll be able to have a look at it. Yeah. So from that perspective, I think we take the view that international exhaustion obviously might be quite positive from the point of view of welfare to a certain degree, but of course it's a matter of case-by-case analysis, and our report, as I said, is more legal rather than economic, but I think there might be a case for an economic report on that. So I'm not going to comment much about this particular aspect of exhaustion.
Касаясь истечения прав, я думаю, что важно, когда бренды злоупотребляют, нарушают права путем предоставления худшего качества.
In this case, I say, I mean, if you have international
exhaustion, если есть истечение прав на международном уровне, владелец бренда продает товар, например, бренд есть в США или Европе, но лучшего качества.
Возможно применять международный принцип истечения прав
для России, например, при импорте товаров из Европы или США по тем же брендам, но худшего качества.
If there is a market for this high quality, high version quality of the good, of course that will obviously probably be a little bit kind of in terms of price a little bit higher.
But if consumers are потребители заинтересованы в получении качественного товара.
Now, but I understand your point that if the brand owners, that brand owner does this, and then you have consumers having the lower quality, let's say, of the Kutsi product, and then you have a parallel trader that imports the higher quality of the Kutsi product, which look the same, but of course the quality of it might be different. I don't know what type of differentiation you have in mind. Then, of course, that might be a problem for the consumer that is paying a premium to get the high-quality version of the good, if what is easy for is not just the quality, but it's also the image
чтобы не только качественный, но и социальный имидж определенный приобрести с покупкой товара.
And have the same type of image, then obviously
если
there are no
not so many incentives for the consumer
to pay the premium to be able to have the higher quality.
But
I guess
имиджа,
it is in the interest of the brand owners to, in case you
думаю,
have
international version, to
ensure that there is a
somehow чтобы обеспечить, что сохранялось одинаковое качество товара в разных странах. Если товар более низкого качества, тогда и должна быть более низкая цена.
Но
тогда пусть будет возможность продукт низкого качества импортируется и в другие страны, и в Европу, и пусть в США распространяется.
Но
будет нанесение ущерба поставщику, его репутации. Нужно, чтобы качество бренда было одинаковым в разных странах, чтобы избежать этой проблемы. Но ваш бренд может распространять разные сорта продуктов разного качества. Например, один и тот же бренд, но в России высшие сорта не продаются продукта. Например, касательно определенных брендов пива. Дешевое пиво под известными брендами более низкого качества в России распространяется. И вопрос качества. Защищается ли право качества в таком случае, если мы говорим о качестве как неотъемлемой части бренда? Уважение к бренду. Если в Ирландии пробуете пиво, приезжайте в Россию и покупайте худшее пиво под этим же брендом. Можно ли юридически защитить? Безусловно, владельцы могут защитить. Здесь владелец бренда решает более низкое качество пива Guinness в России распространять. Как мы можем защитить владельца бренда от его собственного решения? Хорошо, пусть владелец бренда сам он решил распределить рынок по категориям. Но когда он осуществляет свое право в России, должны ли мы согласиться, что вот он имеет право действовать таким образом? Как я понимаю, в России действуют национальные принципы истечения прав. Я говорю о социальной ценности. В России если лицензия принадлежит владельцу бренда, это качество лежит на его совести, на его обязанности. Если вы даете лицензию, качество какого продукта должны контролировать, произведенного в России или первоначально продукта, произведенного в стране владельца бренда? Безусловно, защита должна быть, Но с какой точки зрения на это посмотреть? Если возьмем социальную функцию уважения к бренду, потребитель также участвует в создании бренда. Все зависит от типа защиты. Есть конкуренции на рынке пива. Если качество недостаточно хорошее, это одна из причин вмешаться. Это вмешательство. Может принести определенный ущерб репутации, безусловно. Есть определенные ограничения для владельцев брендов в отношении такого вмешательства. Может, не знаю о специфике вот российской ситуации, конечно. Есть истечение прав на национальном уровне? Да. Закон позволяет. В этом случае зависит, если владелец бренда доминирует на рынке или нет. Вот здесь не доминирующая позиция, но если есть доминирующая роль у потребителя в отношении определенного бренда, есть определенная рыночная сила. Здесь он, конечно, может больше иметь возможности по своему усмотрению действовать. Есть определенные продукты, после того, как они в США появились, 2 года в России легально не поступали такие продукты, не знаю по какой причине. Не знаю, как действовать в такой ситуации. Если компания решает, я не хочу доставлять свой продукт в эту страну по таким-то причинам. Если есть определенная дискриминация в этом плане, не думаю, можно заставить их доставить продукт в вашу страну. Пытаюсь определить, как же защитить потребителя. Помните правило, касаясь качества? Нельзя проводить маркетинг продукта того же бренда более низкого качества. Это связано с защитой владельца бренда. Почему же такое же правило не применять к тому, чтобы продукт распространялся в разных странах? Если продукт плохого качества, нельзя распространять. Как я говорил, есть различные сферы антимонопольного законодательства. Может, это несправедливая конкуренция, например. Здесь касается конкуренции внутри бренда, с вашим собственным брендом. подозрительный этот аспект, если конкуренция со своим собственным брендом, конкуренция внутри бренда.
Интересно. Kind of intra-brand. Usually we perceive intra-brand competition as competition between tailors that are selling the same brand. Here you say that this is competition between different versions of the good of the same brand,
one low quality, one high quality, and yeah, it's an interesting question.
I will be a little bit more reticent than you to move directly to say, well, you know, this is, should be prohibited. Because of the fact
я не буду говорить, что это нужно запрещать, потому что бренд — это социальная функция определенная.
В то же время,
я бы сказал, в этом случае рынок недостаточно эффективен. Репутационный эффект, он недостаточен, чтобы...
But you know, but then I can understand the point of
удержать,
saying, well, you know, in this case,
you might probably even want to do that even for brands that don't have much power,
because this is against
brand,
you know,
principles
approach, and then, yeah, why not?
But
obviously, in this particular case, you need to see what could be the cost for that in terms of enforcement costs, in terms of incentive costs, etc.,
принуждение к применению, какова будет, какие затраты на стимулирование владельца бренда? Есть ли примеры применения таких правил с законодательством США? У меня нет конкретных примеров.
A problem unless you have a dominant position, but I have no idea with regards to intellectual property laws, if in these particular laws basically enable this type of... because as you said, dilution is basically used to benefit of the IP holder. So in this case, it's very specific. It's the IP holder that creates this problem. Consumer protection laws, for sure, might deal with probably this type of issue.
Защитные законы необходимы.
An example comes to my mind.
В России много таких индивидуальных особенностей. Такая у нас ситуация.
Maybe one of the reasons is that because of the exhaustion principle in Europe is regional exhaustion, and obviously, if you do that, you have a whole market of 500 million people, which might, you know, engage a quite important reputational damage for your firm.
Since
you are distributing different versions, quality versions of goods in some member states, which will inevitably be brought to other member states, and therefore, you know, that will somehow destroy the brand value you're trying to promote. Well, maybe here is it's good because it's a smaller market. They might have incentives to do that. And because of the domestic exhaustion principle, they are able to do that. So in this case, you might change the domestic exhaustion principle.
And
that might deal with a problem.
Если в Евросоюзе внутренняя торговля между странами ЕС в два раза выше, чем со внешним рынком, то в России другая ситуация. В рамках таможенного союза торговля составляет 10% с внешней торговлей. сейчас есть новый регион России, Крым, который стал юридической частью России, но большинство американских компаний не признают российской территории, запрещают продажи на территории. По моему мнению, это не приведет к истечению прав, если кто-то продает товары в Крыму. Это не создает истечение прав. Нет, здесь не действует закон владельца прав. Согласен, здесь эта ситуация создает ряд других вопросов. Нет ответа у меня на этот вопрос. Может быть, мы должны закрыть обсуждение. Я смотрю, все устали. Вот, спасибо большое. Как ранее говорил, выйдет книга в июне в Cambridge University Press. Можете ознакомиться. Различные бизнесмены, юристы приняли участие в работе над этой книгой. И юристы в сфере антимонопольного законодательства и интеллектуальной собственности.